Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Alex Olgan, in for Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, CMPD released some of the video of the fatal shooting of Danquarius Franklin at a Burger King in West Charlotte on March 25th. Chief Kerputney says the video is, quote, troubling, and citizens have been out demonstrating. Some use of force experts say the shooting was legally justified. But that call and the decision of whether to prosecute the officer will be made in the coming weeks by the Mecklenburg County District Attorney once CMPD completes its internal investigation. We'll discuss what the video showed, the community's reaction, and what is next in the case. Some light reading out yesterday morning, the long-awaited 448-page Mueller report has been released. There's a crowded field of Republican candidates vying to take on Democrat Dan McCready in the 9th District congressional election. A special primary will be held May 14th, and new campaign finance reports indicate Dan Bishop is ahead in fundraising efforts. Several of the candidates squared off in a debate Tuesday night. A controversial abortion bill that passed the state legislature was vetoed by Governor Roy Cooper. In Charlotte, a city council committee is recommending stronger rules for the city's noise ordinance, and a local clinic that provides abortion is at the center of that debate. All of those stories and more on our roundtable this morning. The roundtable will detail those stories. They include Sarah D'Elia and David Borax of WFAE. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey.
And we have Glenn Berkins from Q City Metro.
Good morning.
Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News.
Good morning, Alex.
And Nick Oxner from WBTV.
Hello.
You can watch us on Facebook Live and leave us a comment on the WFAE Facebook page or Twitter. So first, we're going to start with the CMPD video. 2 minutes of the video dominated the news this week. It came from CMPD officer Wendy Curl, who shot and killed Danquarius Franklin while responding to a 911 call from a Burger King on Beatty's Ford Road. The community has been reacting all week to this video, and as we'll hear from officer Wendy Curl.
We owe it to the community to see for themselves what has been recorded.
Put the gun down.
Put the gun down!
He's got a gun! He's got a gun!
It's like a punch to the gut. It's hard to watch. It's hard to see.
It's too much, and I can't believe it's happened again in our city.
We're no different from 2016 with the death of Keith Lamont Scott than we are today. Nothing has changed.
There's a lot of decisions that the officers are having just a few seconds to think about.
How we respond as a community will reflect how we honor the memory of Danquarius Franklin.
That's Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles. We also heard from CMPD Chief Kerputney, Kristen Huntley, and Sean Richardson, who attended a Marshall Park Memorial Service for Danquarius Franklin, and UNC Charlotte Professor Vivian Lord, who spoke with WBTV. The police chief has faced the public in a series of meetings this week, and here's what he told a forum on Tuesday, a day after the video's release.
This is one of the most troubling videos I've seen. It is. It's one of the most troubling videos I've seen. And the truth of the matter is, I'm happy that there are many levels of accountability. There are. And here's the other piece. I'm not going to defend a thing. That's not my job. I'm not going to defend the officer's actions. I'm not going to try to vilify Mr. Franklin. He has a fantastic mother who struggled. And I promised her I'm going to be a fact seeker and a seeker of justice. And if that means whatever outcome there is, that's the outcome we're going to achieve.
So there has been a lot of back and forth about the video this week. Let's just first get up to date. Nick, where do we stand with this video?
So we still only have 2 minutes and 20 seconds, which is what CMPD released in response to a judge's order after me and Nate Morbido from WCNC filed our petitions in March. That being said, yesterday a judge signed an order for appear and show cause, which is a legal procedure that requires CMPD to appear back in court. That'll be this Tuesday at 11 o'clock. That order was signed after I filed what's called a motion to show cause, which in effect asks a judge to hold CMPD in contempt for failing to follow orders of the court. Specifically, my motion alleges that CMPD violated two different orders entered by the court. The first being when the court ordered CMPD to transmit video of the shooting of Danquirius Franklin. The second order being when the court ordered CMPD to release video under the certain case number. So that will be Tuesday. Late yesterday afternoon, CMPD filed a motion, I guess you could say, in response to my motion, which asked the judge to throw that out. And then it also asks a judge to release the full body camera video, although not in any kind of proper procedure. So it has yet to be determined whether or not that will be heard on Tuesday as well.
So this has been very confusing, back and forth with 2 minutes and 20 seconds of the video. Then the city council members inadvertently, quote, seeing the whole video. I mean, I wonder, Sarah, can we get a handle on CMPD's strategy for dealing with this?
It seems like there have been some missteps. I mean, I think, first of all, the day the video was going to be released, I think they did a good job of trying to get out ahead of it. I mean, they had the press conference with Mayor Lyles and Chief Putney and various city council members saying that they believed in transparency, that this was going to be a video that the public was going to get to see. And I was thinking, okay, they're getting out in front of it. They're trying to keep those communication lines open with the community. But then we have these, you know, various events with Chief Kerr Putney throughout the week. Okay, we're doing that. That sounds good. But then the question of this 2 minutes and 20 seconds keeps coming up. And it's like, what else are we not seeing? And why aren't we seeing it? And then you hear that the city council got to hear the entire viewing of the video. And it was like, well, what makes the city council members so special above the public that they would get to see it and not everyone else? So I think it really is, what happened here? Was this an accident that CMPD showed the whole video to city council? Or was this one of those things where they thought it was okay to show city council for some reason, but not the rest of the public? Jonathan?
I think, you know, people started asking questions. And one of the questions that people started asking, to Sarah's point, is what happens immediately after the video cuts off? Because in other officer-involved shootings we've seen, there's a little bit more video that we see after the shooting actually takes place. Maybe we see the officers rendering aid, CPR. And so people started asking, social justice advocates started asking, well, why don't we see, with the 2 minutes and 20 seconds that was released, what happened afterwards? And so people started asking those questions, and then it gets out that the city council has seen the entire thing, and it gets out that aid was not rendered to Danquirius Franklin. So it's flying in the face of this whole transparency thing that they keep saying.
And yeah. When the video came out on Monday, the release that came with it, CMPD said, you know, it was the relevant video. Relevant, I would put that in quotation marks, that's what they think is the relevant video, and that it complied with the judge's order. It made it clear that there was absolutely more video. It also begs the question, is there other video that we're not seeing? This has been asked at some of the forums this week, and Chief Putney has hinted that perhaps another officer failed to turn on their camera.
Which
is a violation of policy, which he will have to deal with. But, you know, we may not get to see everything that happened there.
Correct.
Well, so this contention by CMPD that they released the relevant portions of video, they are knowingly misconstruing the requirements of the statute. So the way this works, and let's keep in mind, this is still a relatively new process because the General Assembly didn't make police video secret until 2016. It actually went into effect October 2016, right after Jonathan Farrell was shot. And under the statute passed by the General Assembly and signed by Governor McCrory, video, police body camera video, or any police video, is absolutely secret. It is not a public record. So in order to get it, if you're a member of the public, a reporter, anyone else who wants to see the video, even if you're the police department who wants to release the video, and that's important as we go back to the city council discussion, you have to first file a petition with a judge. You have to go to the courthouse, write a petition, pay $200, schedule a hearing, and you have to go before a judge. After you file that petition, the law says, and the order in this case that was signed by a judge says, that the police department has to transmit the video of an event identified in a petition. In this case, if you read my petition, if you read Nate Morbido's petition, the event identified is the shooting of Dan Quinn, mine actually, just because he wasn't named when I filed mine, a shooting of a man in the Beatty's Ford Park in the parking lot of a Burger King on Beatty's Ford Road on October 25th between 9 a.m. and 9:30. So they were ordered to transmit video of the event identified. Then you have a hearing, and the statute is very clear that it is up to the court, that means a judge, not CMPD, to determine what relevant video should be released. So CMPD is taking a section of the statute that specifically refers to the purview of a judge and saying they used that statute in unilaterally deciding to transmit 2 minutes and 20 seconds of video to the court for consideration. There continues to be, despite responses from CMPD in court and otherwise, there continues to be zero evidence that CMPD made Judge Hoover, the judge who ultimately ordered release of the video and who reviewed this video in camera before the hearing, there is no evidence to show that CMPD made Judge Hoover aware of the fact that there was an additional 9 minutes of video.
Nor that city council had already viewed it, possibly.
I don't believe they had viewed it at the time of the hearing based on our reporting. Okay. It sounds like they watched it on Monday, and we can get into that in a second, but that's a separate violation of the law.
And so you don't believe that? Did we hear from the judge that he only saw the 2 minutes and 20 seconds? Do we know what he saw?
So CMPD has told me,
okay,
and they've reaffirmed publicly over and over again now that they transmitted to the judge the video that was released to us. Again, that is not what the statute says. The statute says send the video of the event identified in the petition. And again, if they had told the judge, hey, judge, we're sending you 2 minutes and 20 seconds out of an 11-minute video, they would have to share a copy of that with me as the petitioner. Otherwise, that's what we call ex parte communication. And while there's some ex parte communication contemplated in the statute and transmitting the body camera video and some other very specific information to the court, that's not proper to do. There was no representation made in court by the attorney who represented CMPD at the hearing that they only showed 2 minutes and 20 seconds of video. And then further, if you read the order that the Judge Hoover signed granting release of the video, the order, by the way, was prepared by the attorney for Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police without prior review by Mayor Nate Morbido.
But that's not necessarily uncommon. I think sometimes...
No, that's okay. Not uncommon, okay. But that's just a... Remember this as we move forward, right? That's, in fact, I was grateful that she brought the form to fill up. That's great. But she filled it out, and we had no input, okay? So the form says just grants release of video under the CMPD case number associated with this event. There is explicitly no limitation, even though the form says provide limitation if there is some. There is no limitation. It just says video under the CMPD case number. It doesn't say provided to the court. It doesn't say as related to the petitioner's request. It just says that video. Okay.
And so, I mean, the nine some other odd minutes of video, we haven't seen it ourselves. Only city council has seen it. What have we heard from them?
Well, I think we've heard the most disturbing part of all this is that aid wasn't rendered till about 8 minutes into the video, and there wasn't
medic
any
was called.
Medic was called, and there was no attempt to. We heard from City Council Member Justin Harlow this morning on WFAE that he didn't see any evidence of anyone trying to put pressure on the wound or render CPR or any of those things. And I think that kind of comes back to the question of training, which is on the minds of everyone, not just de-escalation training, but as far as rendering aid training. I mean, these are things that you would hope that if someone is wounded on a scene, a police officer would be able to snap into action and start rendering some aid.
So we know Spectrum, folks at Spectrum and myself reached out to CMPD yesterday and the city to ask the specific question of, one, did these two officers render aid? We know that they did not, that there was no sort of CPR addressing the wound until medic got there. So we then asked the question, well, our officers, were these officers trained, and are the rest of your department? And CMPD says all of their officers are trained in CPR. That was the response we got. But we know for a fact that Wendy Curl and the other officer that responded are not trained in CPR or crisis intervention training.
We're gonna talk more about this when we come back from the break. Jonathan Lowe, Spectrum News, Glenn Birkins, Q City Metro, Sarah D'Elia, David Borax, WFAE, and Nick Oxner of WBTV. We'll be right back.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
We're back. We are talking about the CMPD video, or part of the video, I should say, released after the deadly shooting of Danquarius Franklin at the Burger King parking lot. We were talking about what else is in that 9 minutes of video with Glenn Birkins of QCity Metro, Jonathan Lowe of Spectrum News, Sarah D'Elia and David Borax of WFAE, and Nick Oxner of WBTV. So, Jonathan, you were talking when we – or I'm sorry, David, you were going to add something.
Yeah, actually, so we also hear that the rest of that long video – right after the shooting, Officer Wendy Curl is heard talking about why she did it with the other officers. And that actually goes to the reason why CMPD has not released all of this. Chief Putney has been arguing that there's information in there that would hurt their investigation. Wendy Curl's lawyer does not want any of this released because he thinks it would hurt any future court case against her if she is charged in the end. But, you can just imagine that if she's trying to talk to her fellow officers about why this happened, why she shot him, that that information would be damning.
And it's interesting you bring that point up. Sorry, Nick, this will be quick. But at the very end of the video, and I don't know how closely you've watched and listened to it, there's maybe two or three times that the other officers say, Wendy, like, mm-hmm. like if you were saying to somebody like, Wendy, like, Sarah, what did you just do? Or mm-hmm. not to put words in her mouth, but it kind of, that conversation.
It's a question of what comes next.
Right.
Well, and it, you know, also along those lines too, he has to remind her, like, tell him to put his hands on the dashboard, the guy that identifies himself as the GM that's sitting in the passenger seat in the front. He's like, you know, hey, snap back. Make him put his hands on the dash. You know, we don't know who he is.
Right.
And so there is kind of like this moment where, you know, shock.
You can feel the shock.
Yes.
So let's get back to addressing David's point that the chief has said they didn't want to release additional video because it may impact some investigation or a future legal proceeding. Well, again, that is a factor that a judge can contemplate under the statute, but it is decidedly not up to CMPD. And again, they could have come to court and they could have said, Judge, there's 11 minutes of video, but we think you should only release the first 2 minutes and 20 seconds because the rest would interfere with our investigation. They made no such claim. In fact, they continued to make no such claim. They said they didn't object to the release of the video, even as the attorneys for Wendy Curl and the other officer, yep. Larry Deal, made those arguments. And so the appropriate forum, if that's what you think, the appropriate thing and the thing on which CMPD is required to do under the plain language of the statute is produce the video, show up to court, and make your argument.
So CMPD has been saying before this even came out that we are not going to object to the release. But what it turns out is they don't object to releasing what they want
of what
to release.
They want. That's and that is not transparency.
Well, I think that's also sorry to cut you off, Glenn, but I think that's also a lesson for the judge too. I mean, going forward, I think judges are going to have to be asking questions of, is this the whole video? How much do you plan? And not that it's necessarily the judge's fault in this case, but I think it is kind of a lesson to learn, as Nick brought up, that this is a relatively new law. People need to be asking specifics about what is going to be released. Glenn?
It is a relatively new law, but in the past police shootings, they have released quite a bit of video after the actual fact. So the fact that in this one, the video ends with the gunshots, it just raises all kinds of questions. Why didn't they do the same thing in this shooting that they've done with all the others?
Let's go back to
and there may be
Scott.
A good reason, but and there may be a good reason why they didn't, but that has not been communicated to the public yet.
Just Keith Lamont Scott shooting in 2016, we saw the whole event. We saw them rendering aid to him afterwards. We didn't. There was nothing held back.
Oh yeah, there was a dash cam video that was like, I think it was over an hour long, and it was just the dash cam sitting there, and you really couldn't see it. There wasn't a whole lot that you took from that, but they did release the entirety of that.
And do we know dash cam video in this circumstance?
So CMPD has represented over and over, and there's no reason to not believe them on this point, that this Officer Curl's body camera video is the only video that exists of this shooting. And going back to David's point, we still don't know why there's no video from Officer Deal's body camera. Again, the chief's hinted mm-hmm. at it, but they actually, CMPD pointedly refuses to explain
why
there's no video.
There is if you freeze an image that looks... and I'll be very careful with this, is it looks like he does not have one on
okay.
his chest.
Okay.
Because there are images as we get closer in mm-hmm. where you can see, you know, he had a jacket, the other officer had a jacket on, but you can see where that camera should be, possibly is not there. Again, it hasn't been confirmed whether he had it on his body, but it has been confirmed that he didn't. there is no recording.
Okay. And Putney has confirmed that there is no dash cam video, which is, you know, that's not out of the norm because they've been phasing dash cams out for a while.
Gotcha. Now let's switch gears a little bit. CMPD has been out in public doing press conferences, being at churches, doing this other tour that you were talking about, Jonathan.
It's called the Let's Talk Tour. And it's basically the chief has been at Little Rock AME Zion, where I grew up, East Stonewall AME Zion. And so he's doing these. They've been in churches. They've been heated, but basically the community has been given an opportunity to have a one-on-one conversation, asking him direct questions, even people asking for him to resign and the mayor to resign, which he said, I'm not resigning. I'm not quitting. The city council would have to fire me. But people have been asking you can tell that the community is watching this and they are paying attention to this. They are hanging on every word that comes out of our mouths. And they are engaged in this process ever since. Keith Scott, down to people questioning the training, which is a big part of this. There was a man who got up and asked the question to the chief. I've been over to the de-escalation training over at the academy because after Keith Lamont Scott, CMPD, if you remember, started inviting the public to come to those trainings. So this particular resident asked, you know, I've been to that training, but what I'm seeing in the video is not what they're being trained. So how do you justify that? And I think that's one of the things that the chief has been very open about when he also said that right now the officers are held to a legal standard, mm-hmm. and that he believes that standard is too low, that they need to now be held to a moral and ethical standard. So I will say that the chief has had a very direct conversation throughout this week while this has been playing out behind the scenes with the back and forth over the video. You know, they have tried, mm-hmm. made an effort to engage with the community.
Go ahead, Glenn.
It should be noted that the Let's Talk tours actually started long before the shooting. They originate going back to plans to host the RNC and the chief and
bridging
the mayor
the
and others wanting to bring the community together, bridging the difference. But at every one of those that I've attended, it's been clear, and I don't think it's any surprise, that there is a huge chasm of trust between CMPD and the public. If you've attended any of those conversations, that's just become crystal clear. And when we have situations like this where it appears that video was not released that could shed new light on the shooting or the shooting itself, just the nature of it, CMPD has a lot of work, has its work cut out for them in rebuilding that trust that it had started to attempt to build, especially in the black community.
And it can be a long time before we know what happens because CMPD has to finish their investigation. It goes to the DA. That could take up to 90 days. But there's still a lot of things that we don't know. Sarah, can you talk about some of the other things that we don't know?
Sure. I mean, I think we don't know what other kinds of video. I mean, we know that there's this missing video that we didn't see from the body camera. But I also have wondered, well, is there surveillance video from the Burger King? I mean, I feel like they probably have cameras. What do those cameras show? I feel like if there was cell phone video, we may have already seen that from people popping up. But I do wonder if there's any other recordings. I think we don't know what truly was going on in those final moments of Mr. Franklin's life. I mean, we've heard a lot of narratives, and it does appear that he was having this moment with this man in the car. He could have been praying. I think there's a lot of questions still around what happened inside the Burger King. I mean, we don't have any footage of that that's been part of this investigation that's been released yet. So I think there are a lot of questions about what really was going on in that Burger King and what happened right in his final moments.
And whether Dan Chris Franklin, because the community is also asking, if he was the guy that was reported to have the gun.
Right. And Nick, you had outstanding
questions? Well, yeah. And so in addition to the kind of situational questions Sarah raises, which are all good and important questions, there are additional things that we don't know that CMPD or the city of Charlotte could actually tell us. One of those being, I've been trying to get all week the personnel information that is required to be made public about Officer Larry Deal, again, the second officer on scene. CMPD released the personnel records questions under the statute, as they're required to, for Officer Curl, who fired the shots, but has refused since Tuesday to release the information for Larry Deal. And the statute says that information must be made available immediately upon request.
Just question, they refused or they just haven't complied and gotten it to
you? The statute says that it's required to be made public upon request during business hours. So they've refused by violating the law. That's a violation of the law. The law says you're required to maintain this information publicly. It's required to be made available for inspection during business hours upon request. So that's a refusing to comply with the law. We also don't know still, and we've touched on this just briefly, but we still don't know also why the city council saw the one, the full video, and two, before the public. Mayor Vialiles issued her statement yesterday saying that it was inadvertent that the council saw the full 11 minutes, although it didn't explain how someone inadvertently watches 9 more minutes of video. But secondly, our reporting, my colleague David Hodges at WBTV's reporting, reflects that the council watched the video after they held a press conference at 10:30 Monday morning, before the video was released. In Judge Hoover's order, at CMPD's request, Judge Hoover very specifically said the video was to be released to me and Nate Morabito as petitioners at noon, and that there was no public release to be made until 2 o'clock. The statute very explicitly does not authorize the chief of police to release video to anyone outside of the police department, and that includes the city council. So there was no reason. It is a violation of the judge's order for the CMPD to have released that video to the members of the city council before 2 o'clock. We have asked we've asked both CMPD and the city of Charlotte who made the decision to show members of the city council that video, and so far, silence.
David, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, another thing that we don't know is really very much at all about what actually happened at the Burger King, as Sarah says. And what we have front and center is CMPD's narrative, that they got a call, we got the 911 calls, somebody's in the restaurant with a gun, they're threatening people, officers scream to the scene, they start yelling at him. That's the narrative that we have that's front and center. At the Burger King the other morning, Charlotte Uprising and other folks came out, and alternative narrative was put forward that he wasn't even the person who was most causing trouble here,
there was someone else, possibly?
That there was somebody else who was threatening somebody at the restaurant, and he was going to help, supposedly. Now, I don't know anything about whether that's true, but it does beg the question about what exactly was going on there. And I'm sure if there is a case about this in the future, we may get more of that. But, you know, what was going on at the Burger King?
Sarah? Yeah,
it's interesting. If you go back and you listen to the 911 calls that CMPD, I feel like, has given a lot of clout to. The first call, the person does say, I'm in the Burger King, and he pointed a gun at an employee, and, you know, I saw the gun. And then the way that CMPD has described the second call, it's really interesting. They said it's another person that saw a gun. But if you go back and listen to that 911 call, it's a woman who was in the parking lot in her car, and she's saying, like, she thinks that she saw a gun, and she's, like, clearly freaked out and
scared.
She said, at the end,
she said, I saw him motion like he was reaching for a gun, but she never saw a gun.
I was going to say, so at the end they say, but did you see a gun? And she says, no. But the way CMPD has really couched that is that these are two calls that clearly say there was 110% a gun, which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I will say in the first one with the employee who was on the phone, probably the longest, she said, he's got a gun.
Yeah.
So she may have seen an actual gun.
Yes. Yeah.
But the second person, absolutely, there's no confirmation that she even saw a weapon.
And there's no doubt that there was a gun here. I mean, they recovered it at the scene.
Right.
We can see it on the video. The question is whether there was a threat there when the officer fired.
Well, the other thing, I was actually surprised by how quickly they were able to identify him after they pulled up to the scene. It was really, really fast. There was no conversation. It appears that they just got out of the car.
So if you listen to the traffic, Glenn,
her
body cam video, in the radio traffic, when she eventually turns the audio on, you can hear them describing that it was a car, a red car, red sedan,
where it was parked
in the parking lot. He's kneeling by the passenger side. So I think they had that information as soon as they pulled into the parking lot.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many unanswered questions. And, David, did you want to add something? No, okay. That we will not know, I don't think. Maybe when we get more of the video, we'll have some of those, but not for a while. We got to move on to some other news that happened this week. We just heard yesterday that the UNC women's basketball coach resigned after being suspended. She was under investigation from concerns from players about racially insensitive comments and pressure to play through injury. She had been there over 30 years. What do you guys make of this?
you know, Sylvia Hatchell is a legend at the UNC program, and she led them to national titles. She was accused recently by some of her players of racially insensitive actions and statements. Some of her players have complained about that. They complained to the administration that started an investigation here. Some of her other former players, though, have defended her as well. So last night a statement came out from UNC saying that she had offered her resignation and that it's time for the program to move in a new direction. But it's the end of an era and probably not the way that anybody would like to have seen it.
I'm curious to know a little bit more about what the investigation from, I know a private law firm did the investigation, they interviewed a bunch of players, or that's what the News and Observer said. And I'm also curious, I mean, do we know at all what the comments were that she made to the players?
The only one I've heard, it was, and I can't remember who they were playing, but she made a reference to players being lynched or something like that. They would be strung up if they did not.
Yeah, we're going to string you up or something like
something
that.
Something like that. It was.
And there were also complaints.
It was kind of ambiguous. It could have been taken more than one way, or at least I thought it certainly could have been.
There were also complaints that she made players practice and play while they were hurt, which is, you know, it's a valid complaint if you're an athlete. But,
right. Yeah, were you going to say something else, Glenn?
No,
that okay.
Was it.
Okay, yeah. So I know they start search for a new coach. It'll be interesting to see what happens. She's one of the many coaches, it seems like, in the past couple of years that have gotten in trouble for these kind of comments. And in the current environment, it sounds like lots of investigations. So we want to talk about the 9th Congressional District special election coming up. We're going to talk about the money that's been raised for that so far. It's a crowded field, over 10 Republican candidates vying for the special election seat, the 9th District, where, just as a reminder, Mark Harris ended up not taking his seat in the Congress because of allegations of election fraud, and there was a hearing on that. We're going to cover all that, but just while we start now, I mean, 10 candidates, there was a hearing or a debate on Tuesday. David, what did you hear?
So 8 of the 10 candidates were there at the, it was the Charlotte Evening Women's Republican Club down in South Charlotte. Two were not there. I've been trying to find out exactly what happened. One of them is Chris Anglin, who is the person that Republicans love to hate because they say he's not a real Republican. He previously was registered as a Democrat, and he decided to run for this, as he did for Supreme Court, was it? Yeah, anyway. The other 8 that were there included probably the front runners who've raised the most money. Dan Bishop, the state senator, probably is the leading candidate there, and he talked about how he's the most suitable candidate for facing Dan McCready in the general election. So,
and it's not something they seem to all disagree on. We're going to talk more about that when we come back. David and Borax and Sarah D'Elia, WFAE, Nick Oxner, WBTV, Jonathan Lowe, Spectrum News, and Glenn Birkins, Q City Metro. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Jermon Jackson.
And I'm Brian Martin.
Our podcast, Choose Our Own Adventure, is one of the 5 finalists in WFAE's Queen City PodQuest, the search for Charlotte's next great podcast.
Learn more about our podcast and find out who will win a podcast development deal with WFAE at the PodQuest Live finale, Saturday, May 4th at the NASCAR Hall of Fame.
Tickets and information at wfae.org/QueenCityPodQuest.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Alex Olgan in for Mike Collins. You're listening to the Friday Local News Roundup. We were just talking about Tuesday night's debate for the Republican primary for the special election in the 9th Congressional District. David, you were telling me what we heard from the candidates?
Yeah, so the night went through all of the key Republican issues, and there really was no disagreement. I mean, they talked about abortion, which all said they oppose. They favor gun rights. They want to do more to fight illegal immigration. To me, it really came down to a discussion about who can beat Dan McCready in the general election. He's the Democrat who was 900 votes behind in the general election last November, which has since been invalidated because of allegations of ballot fraud. We heard from Dan McCready from Dan Bishop that he thinks he's the best person to do it. He said he's the only person who's put together a team and the resources to do that. It is true that at this point he does lead in the fundraising. Although it looks like some others have some traction as well. Matthew Ridenour, who's the former county commissioner, is also running, and he's behind in the fundraising, but he kind of pitched himself as somebody who wanted something other than business as usual in Washington. Yep. And that he could help to do that. He's worked on a number of issues. There's other candidates as well. Stoney Rushing, the county commissioner from Union County, also put himself forward as the best person to somehow unite Democrats in the district around him, which he didn't explain that very much. But the fundraising has been interesting, and there's still a ways to go on this, but the primary is coming up. Early voting starts next week.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan?
You know, Dan Bishop, I found it interesting, was using words like warrior and going to battle. Obviously, that is, I would assume, a dig at Dan McCready, who, as we know, is a Marine.
And at Matthew Ridenour.
And Matthew Ridenour actually served two tours in Iraq, spent 11 years as a Marine, so and still is. But, it will be interesting to see who really comes out in the primary. Of course, early voting starts next week on the with the Republican primary. But it will be interesting to see who actually becomes the front runner, because Dan Bishop, yes, he is raising the most money, but then Matthew Ridenour is not even, he said he's not going to do this on TV. He's not going to run any ads on TV. He's focusing on social media and mailers as a way to, reach out to voters. So will that work? Stoney Rushing has a big following, Union County Commissioner. As we know, Union County is a stronghold in the 9th District as far as the Republicans. It was one of the two counties that Mark Harris won. I find it just intriguing that there are 10 people. And now we've got Lee Brown, who is in Cabarrus County, as a wild card. The Realtors Association pushing
$674,000, I think.
Pushing $1 million behind her campaign. So, she's running ads now that have kind of juxtaposed her to Dan Bishop. So it's just going to be really intriguing and fascinating to see who comes out.
Dan McCready has $1.5 million in the bank.
Right.
I think of that group that you mentioned, that money that's coming in from the outside to help Lee Brown is a lot. Bishop has $381,000 on hand. But we were just talking about this a minute ago. McCready has a little bit less than $1.5 million right now, right?
He gave back this week $2,000 to Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. As we know, that she's become a target for Republicans, President Donald Trump, because of what they say have been anti-Semitic comments, questioning pro-Israel lobbying groups. So he
and
realized...
We should say that she's also received death threats.
Correct. So she's a target, one of the main targets, just like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But as far as that donation, it was made, which is interesting, when Representative Omar was a candidate. So she made it back on November 6th last year, so Election Day. And I think it just, he got some flack for it, but he didn't return it until March. So,
and now he's gotten a lot more flack. I mean, it makes you wonder if he knew that he was going to get this much flack, maybe more so than he had for accepting the contribution,
right,
if he would have done it.
I think he really shot himself in the foot with his base. If you read the comments on social media, and social media is not the absolute barometer here, there are a lot of people out there who were disappointed that he gave that money back. They saw... I think it played into the narrative that surrounds him, that people don't know what he stands for. And that was kind of a narrative during his race with Harris, that he really did not have strong positions. And I think this kind of further reinforces that narrative.
Jonathan?
Let me just read the statement that Aaron Simpson, who is Dan McCready's press secretary or campaign manager, quote, "Dan feels strongly that there is no place for divisiveness in our politics. Our campaign is focused on bringing people together. As such, Dan felt it was appropriate to return the donation from then-candidate Omar."
Okay. Well, it's a lot of money in a special election where they're going to have to run about a year later because it's the House of Representatives. So it's going to be a quick turnaround.
Hold on to that $1.5 million.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to switch gears a little bit. This week, a city City Council Committee in Charlotte considered changing the noise ordinance. Lots of different avenues for that, but one of the most controversial were these buffer zones, which would be around schools, houses of worship, and medical facilities during hours that they're open or having services. And, you know, you can't play amplified sound. If this were to pass, you couldn't play amplified sound in those regions or make unreasonably loud noise. Some people that protest outside an abortion, a clinic that provides abortion in East Charlotte, felt like this was very, very targeted towards them. Sarah, what have we been hearing? What's you know, you've actually been out there reporting. What's the scene like on Latrobe Drive?
So if you go to the clinic on Latrobe Drive, especially on a Saturday, that's a day where there are many protesters. I mean, when a few weeks ago in March, the weather was not good, and there were still over 300 people that were protesting, doing prayer marches, that were, you know, pushing the bounds of what they could legally do as far as going into the road, handing out pamphlets to, you know, stepping in the way of cars as they kind of drove to the clinic. So there's a lot of activity going on there. And a big part of the various groups that participate in those kind of marches, like Cities for Life and Love Life Charlotte, is amplified sound. One of the groups actually bought the property next to the clinic so that they could have a clear space to amplify their sound, to hold prayers, to hold their gatherings, and have a space for them basically all the time without having to worry necessarily about a permit. So amplified sound is a huge thing for these groups. They feel really passionately that if they're going to get their messages out to women about reversing their decision to have an abortion, that they need amplified sound. So this would be a very big hit to these groups that believe that amplified sound is part of their technique to get to these patients as they seek abortion care. And I think what's really important to point out about these buffer zones is they're 200 feet from the property line of the clinic, since we're talking about the clinic, but we know that also includes schools, hospitals, etc. But they would still be allowed to hand out pamphlets. They'd still be allowed to have their signs and be there. It's not like they'd be kicked out from protesting on Latrobe Drive. It just really would be cutting back that amplified sound. That sound is very loud, I think is worth pointing out. I've been in the clinic when they've been protesting. You can hear in Calla Hales' office, the owner of the clinic, the director of the clinic, you can hear the protests that are going on outside. So it is very loud. It is very distracting. And some of the things that are being yelled at patients as they seek abortion care, which is legally their right in the state of North Carolina, it is some women that we've spoken to say it is very traumatic to hear some of the things that are being shouted at them.
And this, of course, still needs to be considered by the full council. So yes, it's not a rule yet. But what about in terms of, like, other cities have these kinds of ordinances? I know there's just, like, a variety across the board. Do we know what, Sarah, do you have any examples? I know that, like, Raleigh has one. I know Phoenix has one. There's kind of a whole variety.
Oh, yeah. So in the city council's presentation, they provided a bunch of different cities that they've looked at. And I think the one that comes closest to us is probably the city of Raleigh. They've decided that it's unlawful to have excessive noise at any street adjacent to a school or institution within 150 feet of a hospital. So that's kind of their buffer zone. But then you look at a city like Georgia, and they have a noise zone within the distance of 300 feet of direction surrounding hospitals and those kind of institutions. So it goes around the gamut. I mean, there's 500 feet buffer zones. There's 100. Some cities have a buffer zone around a patient seeking care. There's like an 8-foot buffer zone around some patients in certain cities so that they can't be approached by someone.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if those have held up in court?
I don't know.
And that's a good question, because there continues to be federal litigation already surrounding issues of protesting on Latrobe Drive and these groups, and the city's just been in this protracted battle back and forth. So you have to imagine that any new ordinance that's passed by the city will be tested in court.
What I do know is that the current ordinance, we've heard from Councilwoman Julie Eisholt, that the current ordinance is very hard for the police to enforce. And it's very confusing what the law is or what the ordinance is and how people are actually punished. We know that people right now can get lots of citations, but the proposed ordinance changes would actually have very specific guidelines of, like, okay, the first time you break it, it's this amount of money, then it goes up to $500, and then it could actually go up to $1,000. So this proposal puts more consequences for people, and oftentimes when money is the consequence.
Talks, huh?
Money talks, yeah.
One of the interesting issues here, we talked to one of the protesters this week who said, yes, this ordinance would not affect what we say, but it would keep us from being heard. And he seemed to be lining up a legal argument that it would be wrong for the city to keep their message from being heard. And that's different from controlling what they say. I posted this story that we did on Facebook, and somebody posted a comment there saying, I welcome anything that would bring this to the Supreme Court. So I don't know if that particular issue will get there, but it'll be an interesting one.
I guess it depends when the full council votes on it and what happens. So Dallas Woodhouse said he's going to step down as the executive director of the North Carolina Republican Party. Was this expected?
I don't think it came as a surprise, ultimately. However, it comes after about a week or more of Republican Party volunteers kind of jostling and urging Woodhouse to leave, and that not happening. This comes after the Central Committee of the North Carolina Republican Party held a meeting last Sunday. We don't know what happened in the meeting because everyone who attended was required to sign non-disclosure agreements. What we do know, though, is the result of the meeting in which Dallas Woodhouse says that he will depart the party when his contract ends in June, which he says he was planning to do anyways. I think there are people who would beg to differ with that. So he says he plans to depart after the party's convention in June.
And we should say that this is all after the federal indictment came down about attempts to bribe the insurance commissioner by the chairman of the Republican.
Yeah, so the federal indictment alleges the party chairman, Robin Hayes, took part in a scheme to bribe the insurance commissioner prompted by a billionaire political donor from Durham.
Jonathan?
There was kind of, I guess, mutiny would be a good word, but the Mecklenburg County Young Republicans last week sent out a pretty scathing statement after Robin Hayes was indicted, basically saying that, and I'm quoting here, we, the executive board of the Mecklenburg County Young Republicans, strongly believe that we need new leadership in the NCGOP in whatever form that takes. We appreciate that Chairman Hayes relinquished his day-to-day control, but that is not enough. They go on to say in that pretty, and this came out, like I said, about a week ago, and no one knows if that played a role into pressure for Dallas Woodhouse to leave, but they certainly were straightforward in saying we need new leadership from the top down.
And Jonathan, I think that group was not the only group in North Carolina that's been calling for this. I mean, the party seems to be kind of in turmoil right now.
And I'm sure it didn't help that the party lost its supermajority in the state legislature. It was
they mentioned that.
Right. It was a part of a much bigger blue wave, if you will, but it was felt here in North Carolina.
It'll be interesting
they
to see.
They included, it was kind of this perfect storm of as Glenn mentions, losing that supermajority, but also the 9th District scandal and the outcome there, and also now what's happened with the chairman.
It'll be interesting to see what direction that takes. We're going to switch gears a little bit to Paris, where the historic Notre Dame caught fire this week. The spire collapsed. There were onlookers watching it burn. Donald Jonas, executive director of Caring, was in Paris, and he talked with WBTV.
It was a surreal experience to be there with tourists and Parisians and, you know, people that happened to be in Paris at that time, and it was very quiet. You know, it was like everyone was hundreds, if not thousands of people were all kind of somber, you know, watching it happen.
David, your daughter was actually in Paris. What did she tell you the scene was like?
Yeah, on Monday, you know, we were all sitting around in our newsroom. We have this wall of TV screens, and we looked up, and there was burning Notre Dame on every one of those. And a few minutes later, I got a text from my daughter, who's on a spring trip with Huff High School, touring Paris. And they had just gotten there, and one of their first stops was to go to Notre Dame. And they had been in there right before the cathedral closed for the day. And she sent me a text that said, Notre Dame is burning, but we are okay. It's horrible. And so we had a text exchange, which I actually posted on my Facebook page. She was at a cafe across the street when she spotted the smoke, and her classmate said, no, that's dust. It can't be burning. And she said, well, what if it is burning? And she said it was very, she used the word surreal as well, just like the other person did there. And she said that they were a little bit scared, you know, and I said, well, what were you scared of? And she said, I was scared that it was a terrorist attack of some kind. And quite a moving exchange, and, you know, these kids were there witnesses to a piece of history that probably we wish they weren't.
Wow. That's crazy.
That really is crazy.
It's fascinating, too.
And what a historic building that, you know, I know the French president said they plan to rebuild it in 5 years. I'm sure it's going to be quite an expensive rebuilding effort, and a lot of tourists probably won't get to see what they wanted to see.
They raised nearly $1 billion within 24 hours.
Yeah, so. Exactly. And then we should not mention that there were other churches that have been burned and not the same response. But thank you all for listening to Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup. That is all the time we have. We have Sarah D'Elia and David Borax with WFAE, Nick Oxner, WBTV, Jonathan Lowe, Spectrum News, and Glenn Bergens, Q City Metro. Thank you all for the hour.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.